The trial court is authorized to revoke probation when it finds that the defendant has absconded by willfully avoiding supervision or willfully making the defendant's whereabouts unknown to the probation officer. The Court of Appeals has now rejected a defendant's argument that the trial court erred in finding he absconded when the probation officer could have ascertained his whereabouts by consulting his electronic monitoring data. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Witt, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, the North Carolina Supreme Court recently found sufficient evidence of an armed robbery. Tell us about State v. Perry.
Yeah, this was a case we got from our state Supreme Court. It was issued on March 20th of 2026, a case originally out of Cabarrus County. The incident that we're talking about happened back on May 18th of 2021. A victim in the case named Damon Scott arrived at the apartment of another person, a friend of his. At that time, he had with him some possessions, his cell phone, house keys, cash, $250. As he's trying to enter the apartment, he is struck from behind and falls down to the ground. The defendant and some other assailants then stomp on him. The victim recognizes the defendant as being one of the people among those attackers, but he is struck in the head with the pistol that the defendant is carrying, and he passes out during that attack. He wakes up sometime later in the night, he says, in the middle of the road, severely injured, realizes his possessions, his phone, his keys, his cash are all missing, flags down a driver who takes him home just sort of as an act of charity, but then at home, he starts to deteriorate. He wakes up gagging on his own blood, struggling to breathe. So his niece ends up taking him to the hospital, and it's pretty serious. He has to be intubated. He gets blood transfusions. He's hospitalized for, I think they say, more than 2 weeks, and under that time has to go multiple surgeries. But again, he did recognize the defendant as being one of these assailants, the one that was holding a gun and struck him in the head. And so based on that, the defendant is indicted for robbery with a dangerous weapon, along with some other charges for assault and drugs and habitual felon status. And when that case ultimately comes to trial, the state also introduces some 404B evidence about a pretty similar kind of robbery that had happened back in 2012. And in that prior incident, the defendant had likewise approached the victim, then had asked for or demanded some money, and then assaulted the victim with a handgun, specifically by, you know, as we say, pistol whipping him, basically striking him in the head with the gun rather than using the gun to actually shoot him. The court allowed that as 404B evidence. You know, they said that that was proper to admit as evidence of intent and plan or scheme or design, also absence of any kind of accident or mistake. As you forecast in the introduction, Joe, the issue that's being raised here is that the defendant is appealing the fact that his motion to dismiss on the robbery was denied. And the trial court denied it, basically saying, I think we do have evidence here. Just from the facts I've laid out, we've got the defendant recognizing the assailant, the defendant as being one of the assailants who's actually striking him. The issue that the defendant is raising is there is really no evidence that the defendant took any of the victim's property. I mean, you know, that even with the 404B evidence, all we know in this case is that this defendant pistol whipped him. The victim had property on him when he was knocked unconscious. The property was not on him when he regained consciousness, but we don't really have positive evidence to indicate that the defendant was the one who took that property from him.
But so Jonathan, just to clarify, there was a taking here, right? The property was missing, but it's a question of identity, whether the defendant was the person who took the property belonging to the victim.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that's part of why the state was offering this 404B evidence. You know, we have another incident in 2012, and that's why the court allowed it and denied the motion to dismiss, you know, was saying, among other things, like recognizing him as the assailant and evidence that we know something was stolen from him, that the court factors in the 404B. This is pretty similar to this distinctive kind of robbery that was committed before, you know, approaching and demanding the money and then not having a gun, but then using it sort of as a blunt instrument and specifically striking him in the head rather than actually shooting it. So the trial judge denied the motion to dismiss. The jury agreed. The defendant was found guilty. And the Court of Appeals reversed that. The Court of Appeals said, basically buying the defendant's argument. You know, we don't think there's any evidence here to show this element, or as you say, Joe, the identity of who may have satisfied the first element of the taking. But the Supreme Court here is reversing that. They are saying that we do have sufficient evidence that the motion to dismiss was properly denied. So the standard that we're applying is for reviewing sufficiency of the evidence, we got to view that in the light most favorable to the state. And, you know, we're looking at the totality of it, right? The evidence considered as a whole in order to determine its sufficiency, especially necessary when the proof being offered is circumstantial. And the Supreme Court is saying, we do think we have sufficient evidence here to meet that standard of denying a motion to dismiss on that element of the taking, or as you say, the identity of who it is who did the taking. There's a couple of prior cases that get discussed here as sort of resolving this issue. There's a debate going back and forth between a couple of prior cases, State versus Moore from 1985 and State versus Baker from 1994. The Moore case is sort of interesting. In the Moore case, it was a situation where the victim in the case was unfortunately assaulted inside of a store. She then fled looking for help, leaving behind her purse and leaving the store unlocked for at least 40 minutes until police arrived. Later, it was discovered that her property, her purse, had been stolen from the store. And, you know, without any other evidence to indicate that the defendant who had assaulted her was also the person who had taken the wallet, the reasoning was that mere opportunity for the defendant to have taken it is not going to be treated as sufficient to show that the person actually was, even circumstantial evidence for us to infer that that is the person who took it. Baker was a case going the other way, where the disappearance of the victim's money was found about 30 minutes after the defendant was with the victim, and they concluded the motion to dismiss in that case was properly denied because the victim's forceful abduction, the taking of the money, so closely related in time to form a continuous chain of events. But in this case, the Supreme Court is going the other way from the Court of Appeals and saying, we do have enough evidence here for the jury to have made that connection based on the circumstantial evidence. As you said, the victim's possessions are on him at the time of the assault. They're missing when he regains consciousness. The defendant is the primary assailant of this group of people who are attacking him. They call him a central force among the attackers who started stomping on the victim and knocking him out. And then, yes, also factoring in the 404B evidence where we had this prior robbery that the defendant had committed, that was relevant to show things like intent or, you know, even to weigh in on the ultimate question of guilt. And in the majority's view, you know, it's not our job to substitute in the judgment of the jury. It's not our job to say, if I'd been on that jury, I don't know if I would have been fully convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. The reviewing, the appellate court's job is just to satisfy themselves that there is something, there is some sufficient basis in the record from which a reasonable juror could conclude that this defendant was the one who did it. And that can be based on circumstantial evidence. Direct evidence, as they say, is not required to overcome a motion to dismiss. The majority would say that there's dissent, which there is one, and we'll talk about that briefly, that they feel like the dissent is just looking for a higher burden than what is really required to survive a motion to dismiss. As the majority points out, we have case law saying if there is a scintilla of evidence, you know, in the state's favor on that issue, then it would be proper for the court to deny the motion to dismiss. So that's how the majority resolves that primary issue.
Jonathan, let me ask you about, is it possible to draw a through line between those precedents, Baker and Moore? Moore was the one where the property was taken from the store after the victim had left the premises to go find help. And Baker, it sounds like, was another taking from the person. What difference does it make to buy the defendant's argument here? You would have to believe that the defendant assaulted him, left him unconscious in the street, and some person passing by just picked his pocket. Could you draw a meaningful distinction between those takings that occur from a premises and takings that occur from a person, albeit a person who's not conscious of the taking?
I would say yes, but I would say that both of those things just kind of go to this totality of the circumstances, evaluation of the whole situation that we're talking about. They talk more about that first case, the Moore case, you know, that the woman where she was assaulted, she was in this store. They talk about that store was unfortunately in a very high crime area, you know, so much so that even during business hours when the store was officially open, she kept the front door locked so that, you know, other people could not come in unless she could see who it was and really thought they were coming in for a legitimate reason. So, you know, looking
so
at
it's more plausible to believe that when she left the store and left the door open, somebody could have come in and snatched her purse.
Right. I mean, highly plausible that somebody could have seen her running out and there's the purse sitting on the counter. don't mind if I do. I'm going to step in and steal this purse. You know, versus something else like this. I mean, to your point of this guy is just, he's knocked out. And then a relatively short period of time later, he's just, as you say, found in the road. You know, the likelihood that this group of people would have pistol whipped him and knocked him unconscious and stomped on him so bad he needs blood transfusions and surgeries in the hospital. And yet all they're doing is dumping him in the road. And then, yes, and then another person finds him in the road and all they do is rob his pockets, you know, steal from him and walk away. That would just be implausible. But certainly that would at least provide sufficient circumstantial evidence that we could let it go to the jury. Certain judges feel like, I don't think I would have voted to convict on that on those facts. That's fine, but that's not our job on review.
And there's a vociferous dissent here.
There is. And it really gets to that same point, Joe. Justice Riggs is dissenting. And I think that's kind of her argument, you know, that a motion to dismiss, in her view, that it needs to mean something, you know, and that when we focus on those cases that phrase the standard that way of, you know, is there a scintilla of evidence that would support sending it to the jury, she says that the majority's focus on a scintilla, as the terminology, has the potential to effectively obviate any work that a court may ever do to hold the state to any standard of sufficiency of the evidence on a motion to dismiss. So that is not how she would have resolved the case. In her view, this would be more like the Moore case than it was like the Baker case. She would say, when you really look at the evidence that was presented here, in her words, the evidence presented by the state proved nothing more than the fact that Mr. Perry had the opportunity to take the property from Mr. Scott. But, you know, per that case law, mere opportunity would not be enough. And the majority responds to that by saying, yes, there's an opportunity, but you're not really grappling with the 404B evidence, right? Which sort of tips it over the scale. So it's you can certainly understand why this one might go back and forth, certainly in the jury room, I have to imagine, and then even in the appellate courts. But ultimately, the Supreme Court here is saying this wasn't bare opportunity. There is something else here that supports sending it to the jury. And so it was proper for the trial court to do so. So reversing the Court of Appeals and upholding the conviction that was attained back in Cabarrus County.
And I guess the takeaway for prosecutors is, particularly in an armed robbery case, you know, don't forget about that continuous transaction doctrine. So long as you've got a taking that occurs in the same chain of events, course of conduct, the fact that the person was rendered unconscious ahead of time is not going to mean the state's evidence of that this defendant committed the taking is insufficient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even if this had been something that arose out of a personal grudge between these two, I'm pistol whipping you because I'm mad at you. And then after that, I'm also deciding to rob you. I would agree. I think case law is pretty good saying that could still be the armed robbery. But if it were nothing but the assault and then a day later, I realized something was taken out of my pocket. And, you know, I mean, who knows what could have happened between now and then? I don't think they're abandoning the law that says mere opportunity is not going to be enough. I think this case is just a good example of the kinds of things we can point to say, I know that, Your Honor, but this is more than mere opportunity. I've got other stuff here to indicate that this person is likely the one who did it. And, you know, whether that's conclusive or not, that's a question for the jury to decide.
Right. Second case we have on for today is State v. Friend. This is a case decided by the Court of Appeals on April 15th, 2026, case out of Davidson County. The whole opinion is about 2 pages long, so there's not really a great deal to talk about. But to go briefly through the facts, back in October 1st of 2020, defendant visited the Davidson County Register of Deeds to have recorded a quick claim deed. The deed purported to transfer property from John and Janice Jenkins to Tahira Akila Delilah Trust. The deed appeared to be signed by John and Janice Jenkins on April 1st of 2020, and it was notarized by a person named Christina Horton. Defendant told the Register of Deeds 3 times, apparently, that he wished to have the deed recorded, and the Register of Deeds recorded the deed. There was evidence that the defendant had previously filed numerous false documents with the Register of Deeds office. Indeed, there was an order enjoining him from filing additional documents without prior court approval. The transaction on October 1st aroused the suspicion of the Register of Deeds office. Employees learned that Mr. Jenkins, the alleged conveyor of the property, had died in September 2020. After recording the deed, an employee of the Register of Deeds office contacted the police. During the course of the investigation, Mrs. Jenkins told police that she did not intend to sell her property and she did not know the defendant or Tahira Akila Delilah. Mrs. Jenkins said that she and Mr. Jenkins could not have signed the deed on April 1st because Mr. Jenkins was hospitalized on that date. In other words, there was evidence that this was a fraudulent or forged deed. Police also discovered that Christina Horton, the person who had notarized the deed that defendant sought to have recorded, had legally changed her name to, guess what, Tahira Akila Delilah. the trust to whom this property was allegedly transferred back in January of 2019. Defendant was indicted for accessing a government computer to defraud, obtaining property by false pretenses, forgery, and habitual felon status. The matter came on for trial in December of 2025. On defendant's motion, the trial court dismissed the forgery charge. Defendant was then convicted by a jury of accessing a government computer to defraud and false pretenses, and then he pled guilty to habitual felon status. Judgment was entered and the defendant appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued the trial court erred by denying his motion to dismiss because there was insufficient evidence of accessing a government computer to defraud and false pretenses. The Court of Appeals recognized that under General Statute 14-454.1, it is unlawful to willfully access or cause to be accessed any government computer for the purpose of devising or executing any scheme or artifice to defraud. And by statute, access means to instruct, communicate with, cause input, cause output, cause data processing, or otherwise make use of any resources of a computer, computer system, or computer network. Here, the Court of Appeals acknowledged the evidence shows defendant presented a fraudulent deed and caused the Register of Deeds office to use its computer system to record that document. That was sufficient evidence to show defendant accessed a government computer with the intent to defraud, so the trial court therefore did not err by denying the motion to dismiss that charge.
Joe, I know that the part of this case that caught your attention more was the obtaining property by false pretenses, but that was the part that actually caught my eye a little bit. You know, this interesting idea of how has this defendant caused input into a government computer because you have caused this other person to put input into the government computer system.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've got sort of an agency theory here. They don't use that term explicitly, but you can see how that might work in another case as well. It's not so much that the defendant touched the buttons of the computer, but his conduct caused another person to use that computer system, and that was sufficient in this case.
Yeah, almost this, I think I've got a blog post from some years back that's acting indirectly, you know, using another person to kind of be your hands or something, that we could at least get to it through that theory. But the shortest part of the opinion, I think, is the part that you found to be the most interesting on the false pretenses.
Yeah, the whole analysis here takes place in about two paragraphs in the Court of Appeals opinion. Defendant argued the trial court erred by denying his motion to dismiss the false pretenses charge. The Court of Appeals said the elements of false pretenses are a false representation of a subsisting fact or future fulfillment, two, which is calculated and intended to deceive, three, which does in fact deceive, and four, by which one person obtains or attempts to obtain value from another person. The defendant, although this does not appear in the opinion, you have to look back at the briefs, the challenge he was making was that the state's evidence was insufficient to show his intent to deceive. The Court of Appeals said, and this is the totality of the analysis, the state presented evidence that defendant submitted the quitclaim deed falsely representing that Mr. and Mrs. Jenkins intended to transfer their property to Tahira Akila Delilah Trust when Mrs. Jenkins testified she did not intend to transfer the property. When viewed in the light most favorable to the state, this evidence was sufficient to permit a reasonable juror to find that the defendant used false representations in an attempt to obtain the Jenkins property.
And see, the first time I read that, I just sort of glossed right over that. Well, of course, that's obtaining property by false pretenses, right? There's forged name on the deed, and then you're filing with the register. You're stealing the house, essentially, by filing the false deed.
Here's the problem, right? Is that my understanding from property lawyers is that having a deed recorded is not a necessary step in the chain of obtaining the property, that the property is actually transferred at the point that the deed is signed. The recording serves the purpose, as I understand it, and this is not something I'm an expert in, but the recording serves the purpose of providing notice later down the line so a good faith purchaser of the property can conduct a title search to determine where the deed was transferred and when. But a fraudulent deed doesn't transfer any property. So the question becomes, and this is not something that the Court of Appeals wrestled with, what did the defendant obtain by presenting this fraudulent deed to the Register of Deeds office? What thing of value did he get by having recorded this fraudulent deed? And I don't have a good answer for that. Even if you assume that he acquired some potential for defrauding a later purchaser of the property, the defendant himself was not the person to whom the property was deeded.
Right. It's to this other woman.
It's to this other woman. Now, maybe you can infer that there's some accomplice or they're in cahoots because, right, the person that notarized the deed was the same person whose name apparently was the recipient of this property. But there's nothing explicitly in the opinion to say that the defendant and this woman, Akila Delilah, were working together. So what did the defendant get? The other question I have about this is, for purposes of false pretenses, this has to be a false representation which does, in fact, deceive. The Register of Deeds office knew this defendant was a fraudster, had dealt with him before. In fact, the first thing they did after he recorded this deed was to call the police. The Register of Deeds was not deceived.
So it sounds like your take on it would be that, if anything, this is what an attempted, or I guess a forgery or uttering, right?
It you should know,
making
have been
the false document. Whether,
yeah.
whether it has the legal effect that this defendant thought it might have or not, he is still making this false legal document and then trying to come file that, right?
And the problem there is apparently, and again, I'm extrapolating from the opinion, there was no evidence that the defendant himself made the document. I suspect that's why the trial court dismissed the forgery charge. Why this defendant wasn't charged with uttering, I don't know. That doesn't appear in the opinion. Clearly, this was a forged document, but for whatever reason, they couldn't get the defendant for the forgery. He apparently was not charged with uttering. They got him for the false pretenses. Suffice to say, the Court of Appeals finds sufficient evidence of false pretenses without doing a thorough analysis of that question.
You know, just to tease this out one more little bit, I mean, we talk about how for something like false pretenses, it's a thing of value, right? And almost anything on earth is a thing of some value, right? I mean, a button off my shirt here today would be a thing of value. Could it be a thing of value just to obtain this filed, stamped copy of the deed? You know, I don't know the full facts of this case either. Oftentimes when we see stuff like this, what's going on is you've got somebody who knows a person has died or moved, and so they're trying to get this document to squat in the house. And then when the police show up to try to kick them out, hey, I can waive this document that says, nah, this house has been transferred to me. Would you know, arming yourself with a piece of paper to potentially carry out an unlawful squatting or occupation of the home? I mean, could that be a thing of value? Could it be that broad that just something from the Register of Deeds office is going to have a value?
Yeah, possibly, right? Possibly. That's why I say I wish the Court of Appeals had done a more thorough sort of analysis of this question, because I think it is possible that the state could make a compelling argument that this, as you were saying, just the obtaining of the recording maybe incidentally produces a result that could be of some value to the defendant. I still have a question of how the defendant himself gets anything from that, because
right.
the deed was not to him, was not giving him anything, even through the fraudulent transfer. And the other question is, you'd have to show that that false representation did in fact deceive the Register of Deeds office. And I'm not sure that it did. It's maybe vulnerable on the argument that he did get something. As you say, he got the quitclaim deed recorded. He accomplished his purpose in entering the office in the first place. So maybe that checks the final box, although I still have some questions about the others.
Yeah, it feels like maybe a little bit of a reach, but so we've gone into the weeds. But here the court is saying that this was sufficient
for obtaining property by false pretense. I think the real takeaway really has to do more with the charge of accessing government computers. And to your point, you can get an accessing government computers charge even if the defendant himself had no specific tactile interaction with the computer itself.
Well, and then the last case we had on for today is back to a Court of Appeals case from April 1st of 2026, a case out of Surrey County. And the defendant in this case, State versus Witt, entered a plea back in May of 2024, pled guilty to a few different drug charges for possession of methamphetamine, maintaining a vehicle, and a few other charges. And based on all that, was placed on supervised probation with a suspended sentence of 9 to 20 months, supervised probation for 24 months. And as part of that, was ordered to enroll in and successfully complete the DART program, designated a high-risk offender, and so a curfew and electronic monitoring were also imposed as additional conditions on his probation. However, in June of 2024, the defendant's probation officer filed the first of ultimately three violation reports, alleging that the defendant had absconded from supervision by leaving the DART Cherry program. And then a second violation report gets filed on October 2nd of 2024, alleging a few other violations other than absconding. And then there's a third violation report that's filed on October 21st of 2024, which also alleges absconding from supervision along with some other violations. So there's three of these things in total that are pending. Those come on for hearing in December 17th of 2024. Court found that the defendant had indeed absconded from supervision. So based on that, revoked his probation and activated that suspended sentence. And that's what the defendant is appealing from. And primarily what the defendant is arguing on appeal is just that there was insufficient evidence presented at the hearing to find that he had willfully absconded from probation. probation. Now, I mentioned there were various other violations that were at issue here. Really, what the defendant is contesting is specifically this absconding issue. And in beginning its analysis, the Court of Appeals sort of explains why that would be. As I'm sure most prosecutors know, there are a limited number of grounds that a defendant can actually be revoked for on probation. And this court reviews those statutes, 15A, 1333, 15A, 1344, that absconding is one of the few permitted bases for revocation, that or, you know, committing a new crime. And the court has to decide, is there evidence here that the defendant did abscond from probation? Well, per the statutes and per their cases, they say we have held a defendant absconds when he willfully makes his whereabouts unknown to his probation officer and the probation officer is unable to contact the defendant. They're quoting from Melton for that. So that first violation report that I mentioned, they alleged in total five different probation violations, but the first one that mattered was this one saying that the defendant just left the Dart Cherry program back on June 9th and therefore had absconded from supervision. The second report was not an absconding violation, but the third one again alleged absconding. That's the one that was filed on October 21st of 2024. And that alleged that he had further or again absconded, I guess, by saying that he failed to appear in court back on October 9th and has failed to report to his probation officer. There was also some testimony, and it's listed in the allegations, about numerous attempts the probation officer had made to contact the defendant home in September a couple of times, several more in October of 2024. And so the probation officer says, as of the date of this violation report, defendant's whereabouts are unknown, with all efforts to locate the defendant being unsuccessful, and the defendant has thereby absconded from supervision.
Yeah, but look, this isn't a crazy argument, right? He says, look, one of the conditions was that I have to be subject to electronic monitoring. The whole point of electronic monitoring is so that you know where I am. How could a defendant who is currently being subject to electronic monitoring ever be found to have absconded?
Right. That's exactly his point. The idea, I mean, you know, going back to sort of that definition or interpretation we got from the court, that a defendant absconds when he willfully makes his whereabouts unknown to his probation officer. So seems like a fair argument, right? That even if I have done non-revocable things like not come to the meetings that you asked me to come to or not respond when you left the door hanger saying you had come by my house.
You knew where I was.
You knew where I was if I was on electronic monitoring. We don't really get a crystal clear answer to that because what the court points out here is they're saying in this case, you know, that the defendant on appeal is arguing he was presumably subject to electronic monitoring because it was ordered in that original order from placing him on probation. That was one of the conditions. But remember, early on, he goes to Dart Cherry, then he's absconding, then he sort of disappeared, then picked up, but then missing court and missing all the other probation dates. And so in the court's words, they said the defendant suggests the probation officer could have ascertained his whereabouts if he had utilized the electronic monitoring data. However, a little bit further down, they mention there is no evidence presented that the defendant had been fitted with an electronic monitor at any time, that the monitor had not been removed, and that the monitor was charged and operating. In other words, it's kind of a theoretical argument, but we don't actually have any evidence to say you ever were placed on electronic monitoring. And so, you know, without that, that certainly just we can reject it on those grounds alone. Without tangling with the legal issue of would that even theoretically be sufficient, they say here, there's just no evidence you actually had the ankle monitor on. So we're not really going to engage too much further with this argument of perhaps that could have been enough. But we could imagine sort of an unusual hypothetical, right, Joe? I mean, the defendant who I come to no meetings, I do not open the front door, I'm even fleeing the state and going down to Florida. And yet, for whatever reason, maybe because I don't want that other felony charge, I'm not actually cutting off my ankle monitor. So you know where I am. Have I truly made my whereabouts unknown, or have I just violated other CRV quick dip violation conditions like missing a meeting or leaving the jurisdiction? An interesting debate we could have. But here, absent any evidence he ever actually had the ankle monitor on, they say that's not going to be enough to answer that absconding. Regarding the third violation of absconding for all the stuff that's happening in September and October, at the hearing, the defendant tried to offer some explanations to the court, stating that from June to August of 2024, he was, his words are, on the road. That is, he was walking from Goldsboro to Mount Airy, North Carolina. And from August to September 27th, he, quote, pretty much stayed with his father while his father was in the hospital. And then further beyond that time period, he says, once he was considered an absconder, I mean, you know, in other words, once he kind of knew you've already made that designation or charged me with it, it says he did not keep his probation officer notified that he was staying at different places. And so, you know, again, raising an argument as to that third absconding of, I didn't exactly willfully make my whereabouts unknown. I was traveling on the road, or I was staying at the hospital with my father, and you knew that. And certainly, in other words, had you tried a little harder, you probably could have found me. And the court, again, sort of the way they resolved that is not a crystal clear resolution of the argument being made. They're just essentially saying, even if that were all true, this argument only talks about, like the hospital, for example, is only talking about August 27th into September. It doesn't address his willful absconding from supervision from June to August and then during October. You know, so there's still this huge gap of time that would still be considered absconding. So ultimately, the Court of Appeals here is affirming there was a sufficient basis to find that he absconded from supervision. That supported the revocation. So they are affirming what happened down in the trial court. But your colleague, my former colleague, Jamie Markham, has blogged a number of times about cases that we've gotten on absconding from probation. It's definitely something that I feel like is still kind of, I don't know, evolving, right? Or having sort of the edges filled out about what exactly is going to be sufficient evidence for it. And so this, perhaps not groundbreaking, but is certainly an interesting case in terms of filling in some of those details about the idea that just being on electronic monitoring or just making your whereabouts known, I think this is certainly at least an indicator that it's not going to be an answer to absconding to say to the probation officer, I did nothing to let you know where I was. I came to no meetings. I left the Dart Cherry program. But hey, if you had worked a little harder or you know, dug a little deeper, you probably could have found me. I don't think that's going to fly as an answer to absconding, although, you know, that's not exactly crystal clear here because it's not exactly the facts that we have.
And I guess based on the way they resolve this argument, we don't even have a clear answer to the question of whether a person who is on electronic monitoring is ineligible for absconding, right? Because they say there was not sufficient evidence here that the defendant was actually being monitored.
It's almost hard for me to imagine that a person who is on electronic monitoring and has not cut it off or intentionally let the battery die or something like that, the idea that a person would be keeping it on and keeping it charged and revealing their whereabouts and yet never being home and not returning calls and not coming to meetings and leaving the county or whatever, it would be an unusual fact pattern. But if it arose, it would be an interesting argument to see the Court of Appeals tangle with. I mean, you know, has a person like that actually made their whereabouts unknown when arguably, you do know where I am because you can just look at me on the computer screen and see exactly where that ankle monitor is.
So potential argument, but we don't have a clear answer to that in this opinion.
Just have to wait on that if it ever comes up.
Right. Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Perry, finding sufficient evidence to withstand a defendant's motion to dismiss the charge of armed robbery. State v. Friend, finding sufficient evidence to withstand a defendant's motion to dismiss the charges of accessing a government computer to defraud and obtaining property by false pretenses, and State v. Witt, finding sufficient evidence that the defendant absconded to warrant revocation of his probation. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Our producer is Paul Bonner. Our graphic designer is Emily Hinkle. Our applications manager is Chance Fitzgerald. Our music was composed by Gustav Holst, who apparently hated the violin. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you'd like for us to cover, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
I'm Jonathan Holbrook, and I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped. And by the way, I kind of like the violin.